Evening on 360 tonight, exclusive and explosive new reporting. The former president on tape acknowledging he held on to a classified Pentagon document about a potential attack on Iran, and prosecutors have the tape. Also, the vote that nearly did not happen expected any time now on the debt ceiling deal, just hours after it barely squeaked onto the House floor. And rattling Russia, a closer look at the shadowy effort that's getting high-profile results, bringing the war in Ukraine onto Russian soil. We begin tonight with exclusive new reporting. The prosecutors investigating the former president's handling of classified material have in their possession a recording from the summer of 2021 in which the former president is telling people around him in a meeting at his golf resort in Bedminster that he has held on to a classified Pentagon document about a potential attack on Iran. As CNN is reporting, this undercuts his argument that he declassified everything. And on the tape, as he spoke, it sounds like he was waving a piece of paper around, raising the question, was he holding the classified document in question? Which goes to what CNN's Caitlin Collins asked him at CNN's town hall earlier this month.
When it comes to your documents, did you ever show those classified documents to anyone?
Not really. I would have the right to. By the way, they were declassified.
What do you mean, not really?
After. Not that I can think of.
Caitlin Collins shares the byline in tonight's exclusive, along with Caitlin Polance and Paula Reed, who joins us now. So what exactly is on this recording?
Well, Anderson, let's set the stage. This was the summer of 2021 at Trump's Bedminster Golf Club. And in attendance at this meeting were several of his aides, as well as two people who were working on an autobiography for former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows. Now, Meadows was not at this meeting, but during this time, Trump had a habit of asking his aides to record conversations with journalists, writers, anyone working on a book. So this was not a secret recording. But we're told on this recording, Trump can be heard disclosing that he had in his possession a classified Pentagon document discussing a possible attack on Iran. And as you noted, on the tape, you can hear him. It sounds like rustling paper. Maybe he's waving something, but it's unclear if he's waving the document itself or something else just for theatrical effect. But most significantly for investigators, Trump suggests that he would like to share this document, but there are limits, he acknowledges, on his ability to declassify materials now that he is out of office.
So that's what's particularly important about this recording to federal prosecutors, that he is acknowledging he has limits about what he can declassify. And he's talking about this as though it is a still classified document.
Exactly. And he and his attorneys, they've put out these various, at times, contradicting explanations for how he did not intentionally withhold classified documents. They've argued that he had a standing declassified order. So anything that left the Oval Office automatically declassified. He said that he could declassify things with his mind. Then his attorney sent a letter to Congress suggesting that the only reason he had any classified materials in his possession is because at the end of his administration, it was so chaotic, things were inadvertently put in boxes. But Anderson, what he says on this recording completely undercuts all of those claims. Also significant here, so far the focus in terms of classified material has been on what was discovered down in Florida, especially at Mar-a-Lago. But now this recording suggests that there may have been potential mishandling of classified materials at another location at Bedminster, which is, of course, in New Jersey.
And what do you know about the alleged document mentioned on the recording about a potential attack on Iran? Why was the former president talking about it in the first place?
So this was in the context of his frustrations with General Mark Milley and a New Yorker article that had recently come out. And this document is described as a 4-page memo describing a possible plan to attack Iran. Now, as I noted, there were some people working on an autobiography of Mark Meadows in this meeting. And Meadows, in his book, describes this document as having been written by Mark Milley, though we're told that he did not produce this document. Also significant, we have learned that Mark Milley has spoken with investigators in the special counsel's probe. And Anderson, that is significant. He is the highest ranking national security official to be interviewed that we know of. But that's the key. One of the big takeaways from this reporting today is that there's so much the special counsel has and has been doing that we're just learning about now.
And is the Trump campaign responding about this yet?
They are. In a statement, the Trump campaign said, in part, the DOJ's continued interference in the presidential election is shameful, and this meritless investigation should cease wasting the American taxpayers' money on Democrat political objectives.
So they're not actually saying anything about the content of what we are reporting.
No, instead they reverted to some talking points that we've heard from the former president over the past 5 or 6 years related to any investigations. They're calling it harassment, are referring to it as a witch hunt, but there is no denial that this recording exists or are reporting on what it says.
All right, Paula Reed, appreciate it. Thanks. To get a better handle on all the dimensions of this, we're joined tonight by three people with long experience around classified material, CNN senior law enforcement analyst and former FBI Deputy Director Andrew McCabe. He's co-host of the podcast Jack about all things related to the special counsel investigation. Jack Smith is the special counsel. With us as well, CNN legal analyst and former Deputy Assistant Attorney General Elliot Williams and CNN military analyst and retired Army Lieutenant General Mark Hertling. Sir Andrew, I mean, how big of an investigative breakthrough or how important could this be for federal authorities?
It's huge, Anderson. You can't really overstate the significance here. Now, to be clear, they have a lot of other evidence to work with. We've seen incredible developments out of this investigation over the last few months, and I'm sure they have much more than we're aware of. But this evidence could be really impactful. It, as Paula stated, it obliterates many of the defenses that he has launched over the last few months. It conclusively establishes not only that he took classified information, because he admits that, but also that he knew he had classified information. He admits that as well. And that he knew it was still classified and he was limited in how he could handle it or distribute it. Those are really key elements of proof. And it's him speaking supposedly in his own voice, a recording that I'm sure will be played before the jury. That is very powerful evidence of wrongdoing.
Yeah, Elliot, I mean, it's interesting that he is telling these people in the room, according to the reporting, that, there is this document and this is what it's about, a plan for a possible attack on Iran, but he can't tell them about it because it's classified. If he had magically declassified it, as he said, with his mind or however else he has in various explanations, that would not be the case. He would feel free to tell them about it.
Well, it would still be a crime, Anderson. Like, there's one crime in the federal code for sharing classified information. But number one, possessing government documents is itself a federal offense. But more importantly, possessing defense-specific information is itself a federal offense that carries with it a 10-year penalty. So the mere fact that this might have been revealing containing military information or troop movements, that itself makes it a crime. So we got to get out of this framing of talking about classification versus declassification, because it really, for most of the crimes that could be investigated here, based on information that we have, don't really have anything to do with classification at all. And to back up Andrew's point, what he has said here, on at least assuming this recording says what it says it says, is acknowledging that he admitted that he possessed the documents and knew that they were in his possession and knew that they were sensitive. And that is, there's no such thing as a smoking gun in the real world, but it is incredibly valuable evidence because it speaks to intent, it speaks to knowledge, and it speaks to what he knew that he had. So it is, as far as evidence goes, very, very powerful.
General Hertling, I mean, you've been involved in Pentagon war planning. You know how classified documents like this are supposed to be handled. I don't know the contents, obviously, of this document, but if it's about potential U.S. plans for, of what an invasion of Iran would look like, that seems like it would be pretty important material. What do you make of what the former president allegedly did here?
Yeah, it seems like it is pretty important material, Anderson. What I'd say is Andrew and Elliot can talk about the criminality and the legal implications of all this. What I'm concerned about is the national security implications. There are reasons why we have stiff penalties. There are reasons why we have strict laws on these kind of things, because it gives away our nation's secrets. Now, I would suspect if it was a 4-page document that it was not a war plan. Those things come in big binders with a lot of annexes. What I suspect this probably was communications between Chairman Milley and the president in terms of potential courses of action. And, the chairman of Joint Chiefs gives potential courses of action when the president asks them to. So if the president was using this in any way that he was denigrating the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, or he was uplifting his own credentials with a bunch of reporters, it's just adds to me more criminality, because it's endangering our nation's national security. And especially if it was about Iran, you can imagine who else might be interested in that. And it's a lot of people that President Trump used to deal with.
Andrew, how would the Justice Department authenticate an audio recording like this? And I mean, I guess that's probably not too difficult to do. And how critical are the witnesses who were in that room?
Well, the witnesses who made the recording will be critical to authenticate it. That's easy. You subpoena them to trial. They come in and testify and tell you about how they did it and what they did with that recording afterwards. Elliot can walk you through that in great detail, I'm sure. But the interesting thing to me here is there are other witnesses. You know, potentially, you can imagine a trial scenario in which every person in that room testifies at some point. For instance, the authors of Mark Meadows' memoir, who were listening to this display, will be able to say, you know, what was in his hand at the moment that he was saying this. You hear this noise on the background. It sounds like somebody's moving a piece of paper. Did you see the president doing something at that point? What did you assume that he meant by waving a piece of paper? What did you think was that the report that he was talking about? So there's all kinds of additional corroborative detail that you could add to this very rich picture of the misuse of classified information in front of a bunch of people who don't have any official access to classified information.
Yeah, Elliot, I mean, if the classified document is on his desk in this meeting at Bedminster and he's waving it around or kind of looking at it, or who knows, maybe it's something else and he's just pretending to kind of to make a point. But does it, I mean, if somebody is waving around a classified document in front of people, does that matter?
Well, it does if they see it. Well, it really does, Anderson, if they see it, because then the disclosure of the information is itself a separate crime. If he shows it to somebody who doesn't properly have access to the information, he can be charged with doing that as well. And, you know, again, every single person in that room who was there can be used to authenticate that information and pile on the evidence that they're providing. Okay, so, you know, who did he hand it to? Where were you sitting? Where, you know, who saw it? Who else saw it? What did he say at the time? And it's sort of, you know, showing one piece of evidence may be not that persuasive to your jury, but six or seven witnesses saying largely the same thing and something that, let's be clear, has been recorded on audio. You know, when we're talking about eyewitness testimony, it's far less reliable. Recordings are pretty reliable, right? And if you have someone to authenticate the recording, it's really good evidence. And Anderson, you know, you and I talk about this when I'm on a lot. It's rare that I say something's actually really good evidence, but this is quite persuasive if it is, you know, look, I haven't heard it, but if it is as described, that could be devastating in a courtroom. And I've seen it before where recordings come in. They can just be devastating.
And General Hurley, according to the reporting, the former president at that time was upset about, I believe it was an article, I think it was in the New Yorker that had come out or reporting about Mark, things Mark Milley may have said that the former president, you know, that there, or it may have said to people at the Pentagon about concerns in the final days that the former president might do something and saying that he wanted word if any orders were given that were sounded extreme. And the former president was upset by that. If that's the case, and this, the reason he's having this conversation with these people at Bedminster and with the biographers for Mark Meadows for a book I don't think anybody actually read or bought, does that, you said that actually adds to this, if that's his motivation?
Yeah, I think it does, Anderson. I mean, imagine, first of all, he's waving around a secret document in a golf clubhouse with four reporters. Someplace he shouldn't be. And, you know, most of the focus on these classified documents has been at Mar-a-Lago. Now we're talking about classified documents at another location with proof. It just is an indicator of a lack of care of our nation's secrets. So to me, it makes a world of difference. And I tell you, having been a court-martial convening authority, if any soldier were to do something like that, there would be an immediate filing of a court-martial on those individuals.
General Hurley, people have been prosecuted for far less than this.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I could name some names, but yes, just talking to biographers about classified information, showing pictures without any markings on it that were taken from satellites, reflecting on recordings that came in from signals intelligence, or big dumps of things like WikiLeaks, certainly. Yeah, there's been a lot of this kind of thing when people don't take care of the kinds of things that we call our nation's secrets.
And Andrew, based on everything, you know, we know so far that's been reported, where do you think the special counsel's investigation is heading? What do you think the timeline is?
There's a lot of signals, Anderson, that they are reaching kind of the end of their road. We see them bringing witnesses into the grand jury who are out at the absolute kind of upper echelons of those folks who you would want to talk to. They have concluded many fights of fighting back claims of privilege and dragged those people into the grand jury reluctantly. It appears to me that some of the witnesses that they've been talking to recently look like kind of mop-up operations, you know, the sorts of things that you do to line up specific details that you think you might need in your indictment. So I think there's a lot of clues out there that they're probably getting to the end of their presentation. There's been some reporting recently they haven't even been in front of the grand jury since the beginning of May. So I think it's probably imminent, at least the point at which they will make a decision whether or not to indict. And quite frankly, having already crossed the hurdle of piercing the attorney-client privilege between former President Trump and his attorney, Evan Corcoran, months ago, it's almost unthinkable that they will not go forward and seek an indictment. And with evidence like, you know, like we've been talking about tonight, if they do seek an indictment, it's likely to be a very strong.
Andrew McCabe, Elliot Williams, General Mark Hurtling, appreciate it. Next, with Ron DeSantis on the campaign trail, more Republicans likely to soon enter the race. What will the former president's challengers make of Trump's growing legal problems? Will they mention that at all? And the very latest, as House lawmakers get ready to vote on a way out of the debt ceiling crisis that a significant number on both sides of the aisle have been speaking out against all day. The vote this hour, we expect. Details ahead. We're talking tonight about the audio recording that Special Counsel Jack Smith now has of the former president himself acknowledging he kept a classified Pentagon document. Sources describe the recording as significant and say prosecutors have questioned witnesses about it already, and the document in question is in front of the grand jury. We talked before the break about the legal and national security implications. Now, the politics. Joining us are two CNN political commentators, Republican pollster Kristen Soltis Anderson and a former Pennsylvania Republican Congressman Charlie Dent. Congressman, Republicans endlessly went after Hillary Clinton for her emails. Is this latest allegation or any of Trump's legal problems something any of these candidates have the stomach to go after him on?
Well, Anderson, they certainly should go after him on this. And I hope they handle this situation better than they handled the Stormy Daniels indictment a few weeks ago, where some of this, I think Pence and Governor DeSantis both more or less defended Trump and said he was a victim of a witch hunt, that the prosecutor was mean. No, they should be going after Trump, explaining why he is reckless. He absconded with classified material. He possessed it, and apparently he disclosed it to people without security clearances. They should be hammering him on this, that he is likely to be indicted yet again, and maybe one or two more times. To beat Trump, they have to draw a hard contrast.
But are you talking about should morally, or I mean politically? Politically,
I've run a number of campaigns, Anderson, and if I had an opponent who recklessly shared classified material to people who weren't authorized, I would just be hammering that opponent with this.
So
it's a gift.
Kristen, I mean, is there any reason to believe that any Republican primary voters see the classified documents investigation as some sort of deal breaker?
I don't think that most of them view it as a deal breaker at this point, in part because things like the raid on Mar-a-Lago, et cetera, you saw this real circling of the wagons type effect. But at the same time, if this is an audio recording with Trump's own voice saying these things, again, I don't lean toward thinking that's definitely going to be the game changer, but it's a little different than hearsay. It's a little different than he said, she said, if he's the one who said it. And to the point about Hillary Clinton, you know, I am curious, will any of these other folks in the field finally decide the gloves are off? Trump said this himself. So why don't we go after Trump and say, we criticized Hillary Clinton for this. Why should we give Trump a pass for pulling a Hillary?
But do you think to the congressman's point, is that something that would be an advantage to any of these candidates? I mean, most of them are far behind Trump. Is there a political advantage to doing that?
So right now, I think as a primary effect, as do I not want to vote for Trump because of this allegation, I don't think you're going to see very many Republican voters break away. But as a second order effect, Donald Trump having growing legal problems, him becoming a less and less sure thing for the party, if they look at the 2024 election and they view it as existential, which is something I see in all of my research, that Republicans really view the 2024 election as about the survival of the country. If you view the stakes as being that high, why risk it on someone who is under so many different indictments, who is facing so many big challenges in the courts? And so that may be, if not the offense itself, but the drama around it, the thing that turns some Republican voters off.
Congressman, over the course of the former president's political career, I mean, there have obviously been multiple tapes that have come out, some more damning than others. None of them seem to have knocked him off his course.
That's correct. And Anderson, you got to remember, too, what he's trying to do here. He, of course, will say he's yet again a victim. The deep state, General Milley, were out to get him. And that's he's going to play the victim and hope to get some sympathy among primary voters. I agree with that. But again, but as a general election strategy, this is devastating. Again, and as Kirsten just said, we're talking about taking a risk on a guy who may be indicted three or four times between now and the Republican convention. And so if you're a Republican voter, you have to look at this and say, if we're trying to beat Joe Biden and the Democrats, can you really beat him with a guy who paid off a porn star, absconded with classified material, you know, tried to interfere with the Georgia election results in 2020? I mean, there's a whole host and litany of things here that are just so bad. Plus, there's the fact that he's been losing ever since 2016. Republicans have underperformed in all these elections. So at some point, you know, I think Republicans will care about winning again. They want to make winning great again. And he's not doing that. He's not doing anything to help the party. So I think this is just another big barnacle on Donald Trump. And as was said, it's in his own voice this time.
Kirsten, and just in terms of, you know, polling and talking to focus groups, if the former president is eventually indicted by the Department of Justice or in Georgia, I mean, will that make a difference?
I think you can expect, as soon as if an indictment ever does come down, I would expect, at least in the short term, a bump in his poll numbers from this rally around him kind of effect. I've heard this described as like an antibody response almost, that there's a sense that Donald Trump is under threat. We all have to protect him. But then that slowly wears away as people realize, wait a minute, is he who we're really banking the 2024 election on? So that's what I would predict the polls would look like if an actual indictment comes down around any of this. An initial surge in the polls followed by a trailing off, and we may find that he's got a lower floor than we expected.
Kirsten Soltis-Anderson, appreciate it. Charlie Dent as well. Thank you. Quick programming note ahead on CNN Primetime. Abby Phillip will talk about tonight's exclusive reporting with Trump attorney Jim Trusty, who is representing the former president in this investigation. That's at the top of the hour, 9 Eastern, right here on CNN. It is a busy night. We're just moments away from the House vote on the debt limit deal. We'll get a live report from Capitol Hill next. Looking there at the Capitol tonight, House members right now speaking about the bipartisan deal to raise the debt limit and avoid a catastrophic default. The vote on it expected shortly. Question is, does House Speaker Kevin McCarthy have enough support to get the bill passed? CNN's Manu Raju is monitoring it all for us, joins us now. So how's it looking, Manu?
Well, there is broad expectation that this bill will pass by a comfortable margin tonight, but this did not come easy. In fact, the road has been very bumpy to get here. Of course, for months, there was a standoff between the House Republicans and the White House. The White House refused to negotiate at all, said that the debt ceiling, $31.4 trillion borrowing limit must be raised without any conditions. That was a position rejected by Speaker McCarthy. Kevin McCarthy ultimately forced the White House to a negotiating table just days ago, and those fraught negotiations took place. They broke down. They happened again, ultimately cutting a deal on Saturday that included a range of concessions as well as some spending limits over the next two fiscal years. That all part of a deal to raise the debt ceiling up until January of 2025. We do expect this to pass. And the question now is how many Republicans and Democrats vote to push this over the finish line tonight. The big thing to watch when the vote happens here in just a matter of moments is whether or not Kevin McCarthy is able to get a majority of the House Republican Conference. That is the goal. That is what the Speaker has been pushing for. He told me earlier today that he does expect a majority of the conference. That's what also his top negotiator, Patrick McHenry, just told me moments ago. That is the hope. One big reason why is that if he gets fewer Republicans, if it's a minority of Republicans supporting this, he could face even more backlash from some elements of the right wing of his conference who are already upset at the deal that he cut with the White House. Some even suggested, Anderson, that they could potentially try to force a vote ousting from the speakership if he does not reach that threshold. But McCarthy tonight, very confident he will get there, Anderson.
Is it clear how many Democrats may vote for final passage? Obviously, McCarthy needed help from the other side of the aisle to offset Republican defections.
Yeah, that happened earlier today when the House actually approved the rule, which set the parameters for tonight's debate on the floor. Typically, that doesn't happen. Democrats voting with Republicans, but there were 29 Republicans who voted against that rule, showing that there's some opposition on both sides of the aisle. But there are some folks on the left who believe the White House conceded and gave McCarthy far too much in this negotiation.
Using this process to negotiate legislation and spending, which never has happened before, is unprecedented and unacceptable, and we cannot support that precedent.
Instead of saying, patting us on the head and saying it could have been worse, they could have said, this is the end of the fossil fuel giveaways. I'm pretty discouraged and frustrated that it has come to this.
So that last Congressman Jared Huffman is referring to an interaction he had with the White House earlier today where they said it could have been a lot worse, but he was concerned about some of the energy provisions that were in there. It's uncertain, Anderson, exactly how many Democrats will vote for this, but the Democrats are expected to give up to support, have provide enough support to offset any Republican losses to ultimately get the votes in just a matter of minutes, Anderson.
And assuming if it passes the House tonight, how likely is it passing the Senate?
It's expected to pass as soon as tomorrow night. That is what the push is for the Republican leader Mitch McConnell and the Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer. They want to get this done. But the United States Senate, you need all 100 senators to agree to actually scheduling the vote. So any one senator can delay the process. But the expectation, Anderson, is this fight, this bitter fight, could come to an end in the House tonight and the Senate as soon as tomorrow.
All right, Manu, I appreciate it. We'll come back to you. Joining me now is CNN Chief Political Correspondent Dana Bash, also our senior political commentator Scott Jennings, former special assistant to President George W. Bush, and David Axelrod, former senior advisor to President Obama. Dana, what do you make of how things are going tonight, how it's unfolding?
It has been incredibly difficult to get to this point, but it looks like the House of Representatives is at the point that Speaker McCarthy and pretty much everybody else in private have been expecting, which is a true compromise that you don't see very often. And what that means generally is that you have a number of votes, a healthy majority coming from the center, Democrats and Republicans, and you have people on the left and people on the right who are upset because the party gave away things that those on either side of the aisle, these sort of extremes on both sides, didn't want. The question now is, in the short term, the political question for Kevin McCarthy, because he has such a small majority of Republicans, is whether or not the ability that Republicans have, anybody really has, to vacate the chair, meaning oust him from the speakership, whether they're going to use it. It's not really clear. I will tell you that I was getting a text from a conservative Republican, a fiscally conservative Republican who supported McCarthy, who said that the calls he is getting to his office are now more about Kevin McCarthy than about the bill itself, and that if people are hearing that in these ruby red districts back home this weekend, that may change the dynamic when it comes to McCarthy.
Scott, how do you think McCarthy did guiding this caucus through this process, and what do you think the threats to his speakership?
Well, I think he did a great job. I remember the night that he was elected speaker, a lot of people were on TV confidently predicting that going through the debt limit was going to be the thing that broke Kevin McCarthy. And time and again, he has really, I think, overperformed expectations. People have expected him to stumble, and he keeps doing a good job. So what he's done here is he's brought together a broad governing coalition of the middle of the Republicans, and I guess it sounds like the middle of the Democrats, to do something responsible, which is raise the debt limit. We have divided government, which means the far right of his party cannot do what they want to do, which is do massive spending cuts and massive changes to fiscal policy. They ought not be mad at Kevin McCarthy. The reason they're upset is because we lost the White House and we lost the Senate. And it's not Kevin McCarthy they ought to be mad about. It's Donald Trump that they ought to be upset with on that front. So with divided government and everything the way that works in Washington, D.C., I think Kevin McCarthy did a great job, and they'd be crazy to threaten his speakership over this.
David, how do you think President Biden did during the process?
I think well. I think he was smart to wait to see if McCarthy could actually pass something through the House. Once McCarthy did, it signaled that there needed to be a negotiation. And I think Biden came out pretty well in these negotiations. There are obviously things that are going to anger some elements of the Democratic Party. But the truth is that the core elements of his program are intact. The Republican bill that originally passed the House, tied to the debt ceiling hike, would have decimated some of the things that he had passed last year through the Inflation Reduction Act, including that big climate package. None of that happened. So I think he came out well in this, but I agree with everything that's been said. This is what a good faith compromise looks like in divided government. And this is what you can expect. And what you can expect in this vote is that there'll be a lot of folks taking a free vote to express themselves, particularly to their constituents, that they fought this thing, knowing that the votes are there to actually pass the bill and not tank the economy through default. And that's really what's happened here. No one in November of 2024, Anderson, are going to be thinking about this particular vote, but they would be if it went down and if the country went into default and the economy went spiraling. So I think Biden did well to get to this point.
Dana, I mean, a number of Republicans were portraying this as essentially a victory for Republicans, that Democrats didn't really move the needle at all. They didn't really get anything that they wanted, that the Republicans didn't want them to get. Do you think that's accurate, or is that just that's how they're selling it to their people?
That I think that the leadership in both parties are selling this to their people the way that they know that their people want to hear it, and it just so happens that pretty much everything that they are saying has a lot of truth to it. It is true that Republicans, Kevin McCarthy and his negotiators who were talking to the White House, didn't give on several things. They got some things like a work requirement for those who are getting government assistance, taking back some of the COVID money. It is also true on the part of the Democrats that they were able to hold off on some really deep, deep cuts in social programs that Republicans wanted to get forward. So all of that is true. The question is how they sell it. And the question is how quickly they can, frankly, move on from this. There are always going to be on the Republican side those who say that this was just not deep enough, that the spending is still way too high, and those on the Democratic side who say that this is just unfair to those who need it most.
Scott, do you think it'll be difficult for Minority Leader McConnell to whip GOP votes for the bill if they're needed to offset Democratic defections? I mean, the numbers are obviously still fluid.
I think it'll pass with a lot of votes in the Senate, big chunks of both parties. You know, it's interesting. The only Senate Republican that's running for president that has a vote in this thing is Tim Scott. I did notice he said he was going to vote against it, and Rick Scott and some others. But, you know, he'll lose a few. A lot will vote for it. Democrats will lose a few. Bernie Sanders is against it. But again, I think what you're seeing is there are two different kinds of people in Congress in both chambers, the governors and the grandstanders. And what this has produced is a negotiation where the governors came together and did what was right for the country, which is to keep the economy spinning and let us have the big fiscal policy debate in the presidential campaign where it belongs in 2024. So I don't think it's going to have any issues over in the Senate, although, like in the House, you're going to lose some of the conservatives, absolutely.
David, you said it was wise, you thought, for President Biden to wait on this before negotiating. Why?
Well, first of all, I think he would have had a much more serious problem among his own supporters if he started negotiating with no provocation. I mean, the fact of the matter is, it wasn't at all clear that McCarthy could pass a bill through the House, and that would have set up a different conversation if he hadn't done that. Once he did that, it became clear that it was time to start negotiating. But Anderson, I just want to make a Scott mentioned Tim Scott coming out against this. So did several other candidates, including Ron DeSantis, who was in the House in 2018 when they passed a clean deficit, debt ceiling hike when Donald Trump was president. A quarter of the whole national debt was accumulated under the Trump years, and the House voted three times to raise the debt ceiling. So you have.
Are you implying there's some hypocrisy involved here?
Yes, it's one of the rare times in Washington that happens, and I thought we should note it as
thank
a
you. No, duly noted. David Axelrod, Scott Jennings, Dana Bash, thank you. Still ahead, the Kremlin is sounding the alarm as shelling increases in Russia's Belgorod region on Ukraine's border. Russia's response next.
That's right.
Tonight, Russian officials are on high alert, with the Kremlin calling the situation in the Belgorod region on the border with Ukraine, quote, rather alarming, and say they'll improve their air defense systems following yesterday's drone attack in Moscow. The governor in Belgorod says more evacuations are set to take place as shelling continues from inside Ukraine. He also said that other districts have seen an increase in cross-border mortar and artillery fire in recent days. CNN Fred Plykton has more.
While the Ukrainians continue to deny being directly involved in the drone attack on Moscow, a senior advisor to Ukraine's presidency is warning the Russians the war is coming to them.
All this will increase in scale. There will be an increase in the number of manifestations of the war on the territory of the Russian Federation.
And Russia's not only feeling the heat around Moscow, the Ukrainians appear to be ramping up the pressure in the vast border regions between the two countries. Local authorities in the Belgorod area say heavy shelling damaged residential and official buildings there, wounding several people.
It was very scary. Several bursts at once. This has not happened before.
Further south in the Krasnodar region, the Russians say two oil refineries were targeted by drones, the surveillance camera video seeming to show an explosion followed by a large fire at one of the facilities. And to the north, authorities in the Bryansk area say they repelled a massive drone attack, while the Ukrainians believe the Russians are so nervous they blew up a road in the border region nearby to try and stop any possible Ukrainian advances. The U.S. says it doesn't condone attacks on Russian territory.
We have maintained our concerns about attacks on Russian soil, but we have been nothing but generous and fully committed to making sure that Ukraine can defend itself.
But some of the U.S.'s allies are less concerned.
Ukraine does have the legitimate right to defend itself, but it does also have the right to project force beyond its borders to undermine Russia's ability to project force into Ukraine itself.
Those remarks caused major outrage on Kremlin-controlled TV, as Russia's security forces seem unable to prevent cross-border raids.
Fred, what have you learned from Ukrainian officials about the latest round of attacks?
Hi there, Anderson. Well, a lot of them are remaining coy about whether or not the Ukrainians are behind a lot of them. However, there's one senior Ukrainian official who told me, look, when you see such attacks, when you see, for instance, attacks on oil refineries or even on ammo depots in occupied areas of Ukraine that are occupied by the Russians, all of those are precursors for Ukraine's large-scale offensive, which, of course, they've been planning for months, and which the Ukrainians now say is imminent and could start at any point, Anderson.
Fred Plykton, appreciate it. Thank you. Coming up, NASA holds its first public meetings on UAPs, unidentified aerial phenomenon, what used to be called UFOs. I'll talk it all over with our favorite Harry Enten next. Today at NASA's first public hearing on UAPs, unidentified aerial phenomenon, what are more properly known as UFOs, the Pentagon revealed it's now tracking more than 800 cases of mysterious flying objects, 50 to 100 new reports a month. Today's four-hour televised hearing, which was in the name of transparency, comes several months after NASA launched its own study into the unexplained sightings. Their final report is expected to be released in late July. Joining me now are our own human UAP, senior data reporter Harry Enten. First, so why the name change? Why UAPs?
Because we want to put the focus on the...
Who's
not
we?
We part of the scientific community.
Oh, you're part of the scientific community?
I'd like to think so. Okay, remember, I went to weather camp.
Okay. it's true.
We want to put the focus on what we see and not necessarily the objects, right? And more than that, when you think of UFO, you think of these like flying saucers out of like a 1950s movie. Okay. We don't want to stigmatize it too much, so changing
it. So
it
may not be an object itself. It may be a phenomenon.
It could be a phenomenon. It could be something. It could, you know, could be a shining light that you see going from somewhere.
So what does the data show? How many UAPs are actually unexplained?
Yeah, it turns out that, you know, you mentioned that 800 number, but it turns out only about 2 to 5% of it truly are unexplained. So, you know, most of these we're able to tell, you know, from sensors and stuff, oh, this is something we can actually explain. But, you know, the fact that we have about 20 to 40 that aren't.
Some of those are moving so weirdly.
Yeah.
Those ones.
Yeah, like the, zigzag. And
like in ways we can't even contemplate.
That's exactly right. Yeah. And go,
it blows my mind.
Yeah, this is why we're talking about it, because it blows a lot of people's minds.
So how many people admit to believing in aliens?
Yeah, it turns out that it's more and more Americans are admitting, look, look at this change that we've seen. Up to 66% now. It was less than 50% back about 25 years ago. Younger people are more likely to believe it. And I think the reports, again, we're trying to destigmatize it. And maybe we believe.
Well, I think seeing all these videos of things on like Navy, you know, surveillance cameras are incredible.
Yeah, we're able to, the press is able to put it out there much more frequently. And so I believe the belief is rising.
What do numbers show about how many people think we'll actually have contact with aliens?
Yeah, you know, in our lifetimes or at any point, really, most people believe it's about split 50-50. 49% say we never will. 7% say we already have. I wonder who those 7% are. Another 39% say eventually we will. I'd like to think I'm part of that 39%. How about you?
Yeah. Yeah. Who knows? I don't know.
You know what? That's the beauty of it all. The mystery.
Ooh. Oriented. Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll be right back. More ahead. Quick programming note before we go. Two CNN town halls coming up. Jake Tapper hosts a CNN Republican presidential town hall with former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley in Iowa Sunday, 8 p.m. And a week from tonight, Ardana Bash moderates a town hall with former Vice President Mike Pence, who's expected to launch his 2024 presidential campaign that day. That town hall starts 9 p.m. only here on CNN. News continues. CNN Primetime with Abby Phillips starts now.
Now streaming exclusively on Max. A new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country, Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.